Session number 8939, Captain Ian Hamerton, Reel 10.
You've mentioned the fact that you had to move across fields, you couldn't move on the roads. Were a lot of units forced to do this?
Well, I believe it was all the tractor units that had to do this, as far as I remember, to leave the roads available for soft vehicles.
Did you ever get transported on transporters?
Not until after the clearing of the Scheldt pocket outside Antwerp. And after we'd finished at Blerick on the south bank of the Scheldt, then we were put on transporters for the first time. A hair-raising journey, because we had to travel with the tank. And we got to the tunnel under the Scheldt at Antwerp. And just as we were approaching the tunnel, we realised that the turret, if you had the cupola lids open, would foul the tunnel roof. And there was a hurried shout about, get the lids down. And in fact, we just about managed it. And the radio aerial was bent right almost flat and scraped all the way along the tunnel roof. And the other thing that happened was, as we went through the tunnel, the flail had been put on backwards on the transporter, so the bevel box that drove the rotor was on the inside of the road, and a convoy of three tonners came through from the opposite direction, and every one hit our bevel boxes all the way. It damaged their superstructure and it damaged our bevel boxes, or at any rate the armour plate on them. Couldn't do anything about it until we got out of the tunnel.
So presumably somebody hadn't studied the clearances.
I don't think it had occurred to anybody. First time for everything.
You mentioned the base at Cresseron.
Mm-hmm.
Presumably you were there for some weeks or months.
Mm-hmm.
What sort of domestic arrangements and facilities did you have provided there?
The only real one there was that in the part of the field, which actually was a mustard field, the regimental sanitary man constructed some loos. I understand that they grew some super crops of mustard thereafter. We received our boxes of rations there. We had the 15 man one day packs, which we made for 5 men for 3 days, which worked all right. Some were better than others. As I can't remember which serial letter we all used to go for, K pack or the L pack or whatever. Some had haricot oxtail in, which we abhorred. Some had Christmas pudding in, which was very nice. In fact, later on, in Belgium, we were sitting around our billy can one day, talking about nothing in particular and saying that, you know, we like this pack better than that pack, the usual sort of idiotic conversation one has. And the upshot of it was I wrote to Peak Friends to say how much we enjoyed their tinned Christmas pudding. And I got a letter back. They were thrilled to bits to hear that our Christmas puds went down well. They put a copy of the letter on all the notice boards in their factory, and any time we were there, would we please call in, and they'd be delighted to show us round. I took advantage of that after the war.
You were a sponsored unit.
Oh, yes. The haricot oxtail, after its initial discovery, was stuffed below the turret floor in a hideaway places, came in very handy for supplying in exchange for tomatoes and eggs and other goodies from the local population. In fact, I know that sounds a bit facetious, but in fact, of course, in many cases, it provided some instant relief to people who'd had very little. For some parts of Normandy, they suffered terribly.
And were they happy to have the haricot?
Oh yes, perfectly. Very, very happy.
Were you able to do a lot of local purchasing?
No, we weren't. At Cresseron, there were, although we were near a farm, there was a little bit of bartering went on, but not very much. I think we were much too busy. You asked just now about facilities. The other facility, of course, was the bathing with the shower unit, where one was given, one handed in one's dirty shirt and vest and pants and socks and got a clean set, not necessarily the same size when one came out, but at least it was clean. And the other thing was, I think this was in July, while we were there, very hot, and the message came, would we like to go for a bathe on the beach? And brother officer, who commanded 4th Troop, and his sergeant, came along and said, come on, Ham, come for a bathe. And I said, right-ho. But before I'd got my things together, I had a change of mind, and I didn't go with them. And in fact, while they were on the beach, a shell came over from Le Havre area and landed right on them, and they were killed instantly. So it's another one of my lucky escapes. But I don't know why I didn't go with them. It was just a feeling.
Did you have days when you were left with nothing to do at Cresseron, slack days?
Yes. Well, slack in the sense that one was usually doing maintenance and checking guns and loading and attending an O group or something like that. One particular O group just the other side of the hedge, and one of my crew came galloping along a bit late, one of my troop rather came galloping a bit late, jumped through the hedge, landed right next to us, and his Sten gun went off right through everybody, but didn't hit anybody. Sorry, that was another digression.
What could you actually do to keep yourself amused and occupied if you weren't actually doing anything, you know, if there was a really...
Talk and write letters. I think we all wrote lots of letters. And of course, troop officers had to censor their own troops' letters. And we wrote to everybody we could think of. We did a lot of talking. There wasn't an awful lot of spare time, and we didn't get a chance to get out of the camp at all.
You mentioned the loos and the bath unit. Was there any attempt to set up any sort of mess or collective feeding?
Oh, no. Well, not for us anyway. I believe there was for regimental headquarters, but we were always on more or less instant call. Well, we didn't have much time. If we got a call, we had to go fairly quickly.
You were mentioning getting a certain amount of extra food. What about drink? Did you manage to get any of that?
No.
No Calvados?
No. The first time I touched Calvados was after Falaise was over. We were withdrawn after that bombing by the RAF. Back down on the banks of the Orne, just south of Caen, near Louvigny. Horrible place. The Orne was flowing along with bodies of cattle and people. And we all got dysentery. That wasn't very nice. And we stayed there for 10 days or so, I think, while our engines were being changed by base workshops. As soon as that was completed, we set off, this time as squadrons. And we had to go on a cross-country route, in our case, towards Le Havre. I think we crossed the Seine at Rouen. We must have done, because that's where the bridges were, for the Bailey bridges put up. But before we got there, we went through some fairly untouched countryside, and we stopped for a 20-minute halt at one place near an old farmhouse, and we noticed smoke coming out of the roof. So we dismounted our fire extinguishers, CO2 bottles. The sergeant major brought a stirrup pump out of his scout car, and some climbed up on the roof and squirted down the chimney, and others rushed into the farmhouse and squirted up the chimney. The sergeant major was one of those squirting up, and of course hadn't reckoned with all the soot coming down, and he was smothered. But we put the fire out, and the farmer was so thrilled. He said, wait a minute, I'll just give you something. And he went down in the cellar, came back with a tray with the tiniest glasses we'd ever seen, and the tiniest jug we'd ever seen. The glasses were little thimbles in size, a very small little jug. And he was indicating that this was something special. We all thought he was a bit mean. Anyway, he poured this stuff, pure colourless liquid, into the glasses, and my lips touched it, and I think my berry flew about 3 feet in the air. That was the only time I've ever tasted Calvados. I wasn't very keen on the idea.
You mentioned having O groups.
Mm-hmm.
How were O groups conducted?
Ooh. Well, obviously there was, since we usually worked in troops up to Le Havre, apart from the radar station attack, which I haven't mentioned, we worked as troops, individual troops. So the troop leader got his information from the squadron leader, squadron commander, and then I'd get my tank commanders together and explain what we were going to do, distribute maps, all the details and so on, then they'd tell their crews, or I'd have the whole troop together and explain. We believed in keeping everybody fully in the picture so that anybody could take over at any moment.
When you went to a squadron or group, how long would it normally take to conduct?
I honestly can't remember. It would all depend on what was going to happen, I think, what the battle was going to be. The one before the radar station involved the whole of our squadron, B squadron, Avrys and Royal Marines. I don't know how long the O group took, but I do remember climbing up a tree just outside Douvres-la-Delivrande, which overlooked the battlefield where this radar station was. It was up on the hill. There's a gymnasium there now. And that was an absolute classic set-piece battle for assault troops on a heavily defended position. My troop was involved with a diversionary enfilade fire from one side while the rest of the attack went in, and the commandos, well, I think, were rather shattered. They didn't even put their steel helmets on. I think we lost a couple of Avrys that blew up on mines, and because they were carrying explosive they really did blow. Quite a lot of prisoners were taken, but it was a very deep shelter. They'd held out for 3 or 4 weeks. It was a little thorn in everybody's side. In fact, the road ran right through the radar station, and several people drove right through it without being fired on. But as soon as an attack was mounted, they all responded. And they had these Tobruk shelters and things like that. Coming back to the O group, when we did the Le Havre battle, the O groups took place at Chateau Barclair at Bolbec, where the whole regiment was. There was sort of beech woods all around the chateau. I remember we occupied some German hutments, which were dug below ground level, and because of the heavy rain, flooded, and we put our beds, we made up beds on the German bunks, resting on jerry cans, but the greatcoat or whatever you used as bedclothes sort of trailed over the sides, got soaking wet. I had a stinking cold there. There was also a German cemetery there, laid out in the form of an iron cross. But get back to the O group, we got our main briefing for the attack there, as I remember. But prior to it, a couple of days before the assault, I went on a foot recce with some of the resistance, who took me up to the front edge of the minefield. And we crawled along and had a good look there. But as far as the rest of O group things, I cannot remember.
Do you remember if they were conducted according to a formal pattern on every occasion?
Oh, I think one went through the usual sort of what's known about the enemy and what's known about our own troops and who was with whom and who was under command and what the artillery were doing and what the Air Force were doing and that sort of thing.
So it's done according to the formula?
Yes. Yeah, as far as I remember.
When you were given orders, were they normally written orders or verbal orders?
Well, as far as troop things were concerned, they were often verbal. I can't recall receiving any written ones myself.
Would you normally take notes when you were being...
Oh, yes. Usually in Chinagraph pencil on the talc on the map board, so that they could be rubbed out. Yes, we marked up maps and all that sort of thing.
When you were going through such a briefing or an O group, did you maintain this tradition of taking questions and suggestions at the end?
I can't remember.
So I asked this because I can remember you saying that when you were in training at Orford, it was the practice
to have
conferences to discuss important...
I think we had a number of conferences in between. Well, this is one of the things, yes, we did do in between whiles, when we did sort of had a post-mortem. And people came up with ideas and one passed them on. Yes, that happened.
Were you ever asked to give advice as experts, you know, by senior levels outside the squadron or outside the regiment?
Oh, yes. For instance, at Le Havre, this is a case in point, our colonel who landed just after D-Day was Colonel Gerald Grosvenor. But he was very severely wounded within a matter of a few weeks, I think. And then, I think it was after Goodwood, when the third CLY were decimated, Colonel Anderson came to us. Now, he didn't know anything about flails at all. And the next big thing, apart from the night attack, which was all laid on anyway, was the Le Havre battle, which was going to be a set piece again against a heavily defended position, the sort of thing that we'd done all our training for. And as I say, it had rained very heavily and the ground was very, very bad going. Now, Major Plowden, who was our second in command, had to brief Colonel Anderson on what flails could and could not do under these conditions. And the two of them had to pass on this information at their O groups up at, I suppose, brigade level. Major Plowden was saying the other day about doing this very thing, how they had to convince people that flails just could not flail at the correct flailing speed if the going was too soft. And in fact, at Le Havre, several lanes came unstuck because they missed mines, because the ground was so soft.
Cushioned.
Yes. I believe I told you I was extremely lucky and managed to avoid mines.
Did you ever get visits from senior officers?
If you count the new squadron commander who came to see me at Romville, yes. If you count the brigadier who came to inquire why we were firing so much ammunition, yes. After Le Havre, I think it was after rather than before, at Chateau Buccleuch, we had a visit from Gertrude Lawrence, who doesn't count as a senior officer, but there were a number of senior officers present. I personally wasn't present for some reason, I don't know why, but there was quite a do. I think it was after the battle she came to entertain the troops. We did see General Hobart from time to time, but I can't remember where. And the only other time, we saw the Colonel from time to time, because he made a point of trying to get to visit everybody so that everybody would know who he was. And it's very difficult for the poor man with such a scattered regiment to command. And later on, when he left us to resume command of a CLY regiment in the Reichswald battle, we then received a new colonel. And he came to see us, I remember, and at the Battle of Bremen, he had by that time acquired a rather poor reputation amongst the troops, and when he drove in front of me, I was in a hidden position. We were firing at some bunkers by the aerodrome, the Fokker Wolf factory. And the silly fool rode on a scout car right in front of us, and I had to physically stop my gunner from aiming at him. So yes, we did get some visits.
Why was he so unpopular?
Unlike Colonel Anderson, who believed in laying on an attack with every possible, trying to make it every possible chance of success, with the right artillery support, infantry support, and so on and so forth, and taking every precaution, this other gentleman was out for a gong.
He was a pot hunter, was he?
He was a pot hunter. And he came with the reputation that he'd been recommended simply so that the other regiment could get rid of him. He'd been their second in command. That's the reputation he brought with him. Now, how true it was, I can't say, but he did volunteer our services on every possible occasion, where we would have been quite content for somebody to come and ask us to do something, which is quite a different matter.
What do you think was the crucial level of command in your activity? Was it squadron level or regimental level?
It was squadron level, yeah. The only time the regiment worked as a regiment was at Le Havre. And perhaps for the first assault on the Siegfried Line from Nijmegen to Cleve. But squadrons were usually serving with different units, different corps even. And as I say, troops were often under command of various infantry or tank units. I was under command of the Guards Brigade in the Reichswald for quite a time. Then I had half a squadron at that time.
When you were under command of an infantry battalion, did you find it an easy working relationship?
If the infantry knew what they were about and what we were about, yes. But sometimes they thought we were a nuisance because we drew fire. And they were very hostile to that idea. Others were very cooperative. I cannot remember the infantry unit it was, but on our way through Germany, before we got to Delmenhorst, near Bremen, we came to a little village of Adelheid. And the SS had formed a line of defence there. They were being very awkward. Oh, they were jumping up out of their trenches and yelling Heil Hitler and firing like blazes. And I liaised with the company commander, you know, right on the spot, and we together planned our moves. It was just after doing just such a thing that I was climbing back into the tank, and I got one leg in the cupola, and a mortar shell landed on the front of the turret, and fortunately for me, burst downwards, and it blew my machine gun up in the air, the anti-aircraft Browning, and the box of ammo. It blew my operator's gas cape full of holes. It blew some shrapnel down through the periscope and it lodged in the driver's beret. And it knocked me off the turret and I landed on the back of my neck down on the ground. And just a few bits in my face and my hands, but